Chapter 27. Modern Dover is a bustling port city best known for its ferry to Calais and its world-famous white chalk cliffs up the easterly coastline. Julie drove into the historic city center before pulling over and asking for directions. They found Dorchester Lane a few blocks from the waterfront, a quiet residential street lined with old brick row houses constructed in the 1880s. Parking the car under a towering birch tree, the women walked up the cleanly swept steps of number 14 and rang the bell. After a long pause, the door was pulled open by a disheveled woman in her 20s who held a sleeping baby in her arms.
"Oh, I'm terribly sorry to bother you," Julie whispered. "I hope we didn't wake the baby."
The woman shook her head and smiled.
"This one could sleep through a U2 concert."
Julie quietly introduced the two of them.
"We are seeking information on a man who lived at this address quite some time ago. His name was Norman Wingate."
"That was my grandfather," the woman replied, perking up.
"I'm Erica Norris. Wingate was my mother's maiden name."
Julie looked at Summer and smiled in disbelief.
"Please, won't you come in?" Norris offered.
The young woman led them into a modest yet warmly decorated family room, easing herself into a rocking chair with the sleeping baby.
"You have a lovely home," Julie said.
"My mum grew up in this house.
I think she said grandfather bought it just before World War I. She lived here most of her life, as she and Dad purchased the home from him."
"Is she still alive?"
"Yes, she's a spry 94. We had to move her into the old folks' home a few months back so she could receive proper nursing care. She insisted that we move in here when the baby was on the way. More room for us, at least."
"Your mum might still be able to help us out," Julie said. "We are looking for some old records from the war that your grandfather might have had in his possession." Norris thought for a moment.
"Mum did end up with all of my grandparents' belongings," she said. "I know she got rid of most of it over the years, but there are some old books and photographs in the nursery that you were welcome to have a look at."
She cautiously led them up a flight of stairs and into a pale blue room with a wooden crib on one wall. She gently lay the baby in the crib, eliciting a slight whimper from him before he drifted back to sleep.
"Over here are my grandfather's things," she whispered, stepping to a high wooden shelf.
Old cloth-bound books filled the shelves, fronted by black-and-white photographs of men in uniform. Julie picked up one photograph showing a young soldier standing next to Kitchener.
"Is this your grandfather?"
"Yes, with Lord Kitchener.
He headed up the entire army during the war, did you know?"
Julie smiled.
"Yes, he's actually the reason we are here. Grandfather often spoke about how he would have died along with Kitchener on his ship that sank during a voyage to Russia. But his father was gravely ill, and Kitchener had excused him from the trip.
Erica, we found a letter from your grandfather indicating that Kitchener had sent him his personal diary for safekeeping," Julie said. "We're hoping to locate that diary."
"If grandfather kept it, it would be here. Please have a look."
Julie had read Kitchener's earlier diaries, which had been kept in small hardbound books. Scanning the shelves, she froze when she spotted a similarly bound book on the top shelf.
"Summer, can you reach that small blue book up high?" she asked nervously.
Stretching to her toes, Summer reached up and pulled the book down and handed it to Julie. The historian's heart began to beat faster when she noticed there was no title printed on the spine or front cover. Slowly opening the cover, she turned to a lined title page. In neat handwritten script was written, "Journal of H.H.K., January 1st, 1916.
"That's it," Summer blurted, staring at the page.
Julie turned the page and began reading the first entries, which described efforts by the author to boost compensation for new military recruits. She soon flipped to the last written entry, located halfway through the book, which was dated June 1st, 1916. She then closed the book and looked hopefully at Norris.
"This lost diary has long been sought by historians of Kitchener," she said quietly. "If it means that much to you,
Then go ahead and take it, Norris replied, waving her hand at the book as if it were of no consequence. No one around here is likely to be reading it any time soon, she added, smiling toward her sleeping baby. I will donate it to the Kitchener Collection at Broome Park, if you should ever change your mind about that. I'm sure Grandfather would be thrilled to know that there are still people around with an interest in Kitchener and the Great War, as he used to call it. Julian Summer thanked the young mother for the diary, then tiptoed down the stairs and out of the house. Your detour to Dover certainly produced an unexpected bit of good luck, Julie said with a smile as they stepped to her car. Persistence leads to luck every time, Summer replied. Excited with their discovery, Julie was oblivious of the black motorcycle that followed them off Dorchester Lane and onto the road to Canterbury, holding a steady pace several cars behind. As Julie drove, Summer skimmed through the diary, reading passages of interest out loud. Listen to this, she said. March 3rd. Received an unexpected letter from the Archbishop of Canterbury requesting a private viewing of the manifest. The cat has finally escaped the bag, though how I do not know. The late Dr. Worthington had assured me his secrecy in life, but perhaps he has failed me in death. No matter. I declined the Archbishop's invitation while risking his ire, in hopes that the matter can be deferred until the time when we are once again at peace. Dr. Worthington, you say? Julie asked. He was a well-known Cambridge archaeologist around the turn of the last century. He carried out several high-profile excavations in Palestine, if my memory serves. That would seem an odd connection, Summer replied, skimming more pages. Kitchener was right about upsetting the Archbishop, though. 2 weeks later, he has this to say. Called upon this morning by Bishop Lowry of Portsmouth on behalf of Archbishop Davidson, he eloquently expressed a strong desire for me to donate the manifest to the Church of England for the good of all mankind. He failed to elaborate, however, on the Church's intended use of the document. From the earliest moments, my kindred hopes were for a benevolent quest for the truth. It is now regrettably apparent that my church is reacting in fear, with suppression and concealment their primary aim. In their hands, the manifest might disappear for all posterity. This I cannot allow, and I informed Bishop Lowry as much, to his extreme disappointment. Though now is not the time, I believe that at the conclusion of this great conflict, a public release of the manifest will offer a spark of hope for all mankind. He certainly makes this manifest sound profound, Julie said. And now Bishop Lowry has made an appearance. His cryptic letter to Davidson in June suddenly becomes more interesting. Kitchener doesn't provide much detail, but his anguish with the church keeps growing, Summer said. In April, he writes, plans for the summer offensive in France are nearly complete. The constant harassment from the Archbishop's minions is becoming overwhelming. PM has approved my request for a security detail. Thankfully, I didn't have to specify why. So our friends Wingate and Stearns finally appear on the scene, Julie noted. Summer thumbed faster through the pages as they approached the outskirts of Canterbury. In his April and May passages, he is bogged down with war planning and an occasional weekend away with relatives at Broome Park. Wait, though, listen to this. May 15th. Received another threatening call from Bishop Lowry. With his nefarious manner, I believe the country would be better served if he headed the Directorate of Military Intelligence rather than the Portsmouth Diocese. A day later, he writes, caught in a street-side confrontation by an anonymous C of E member who demanded the manifest. Corporal Stearns disposed of the renegade without further incident. I'm beginning to regret ever discovering the blasted thing back in 77, or letting Dr. Worthington decipher it last year. Who would have imagined that an old slip of papyrus sold by a beggar during our survey of Palestine would have such consequence? Summer turned to the next page. Does that date mean anything to you? Julie contemplated her earlier writings on Kitchener. That was well before his famous heroics in Khartoum. In 1877, I believe he was stationed in the Middle East. That's about the time that he took over an army survey party in northern Palestine, as part of the Palestine Exploration Fund established by Queen Victoria. He worked as a surveyor? Yes, and he took over the field survey team when its commander fell ill. They did quite top-notch work, despite being threatened on several occasions by local Arab tribesmen. Much of the Palestine survey data was, in fact, still being utilized as recently as the 1960s. But as for Kitchener, he was traveling throughout the Middle East at that point, so there's no telling where he specifically may have acquired it. Unfortunately, he didn't begin keeping a diary until many years later. It must be very old if it is a papyrus document. Summer neared the end of the diary and halted at a late May entry. Julie, this is it, she gasped. He writes, another dire warning received from the Archbishop. I dare say they seem to be stopping at nothing in obtaining their desired wants. I have little doubt they haven't already slipped into Broome Park for a look around. My response will hopefully put them at bay. I told them that I am taking the manifest to Russia and placing it on loan with the Orthodox Church in Petrograd for safekeeping until the war's end. Imagine their chagrin if they knew I actually safeguarded it with Sally, under the watchful eyes of Emily, till my return. So he didn't take it to Russia, Julie said, her voice crackling with excitement. Apparently not. Listen to this. On June 1st, he writes, my last entry for now. Prying eyes seem to be everywhere. I feel an uneasy dread about the trip at hand, but it is vital that the Russians stay with us and not negotiate a unilateral armistice with Germany. We'll pass this diary to Corporal Wingate for safekeeping, HHK. I've read other accounts that he was uneasy when he departed and seemed to be dreading the trip, said Julie. He must have had a premonition. Probably so, or he wouldn't have left the diary behind. But the bigger question is, who was Sally? She must have been someone trustworthy, but I don't believe I've ever run across anyone named Sally in my research on Kitchener. Not an old secretary, or perhaps the wife of a fellow officer? Summer asked. Julie shook her head. How about a pet name for one of his aides? No, I should think there would be references in his correspondence somewhere, but I don't recall seeing it. It doesn't seem right that he would trust a casual acquaintance with the document. How about the other name, Emily? Julie thought for a moment as she waited to enter a traffic roundabout that led to downtown Canterbury. I can recall two Emilys, actually. Kitchener's maternal grandmother was named Emily, though she was long dead by 1916. Then there was his oldest brother, who had a granddaughter named Emily. I'll have to check my genealogy records when we get to the hotel to see when she was born. Her father, Kitchener's nephew, was named Hal. He used to visit Broome Park rather regularly. So the younger Emily would actually be a cousin to Aldrich? Summer asked. Yes, that would be correct. Perhaps we can talk to Aldrich about her in the morning. Julie had reached the city center and drove Summer slowly past Canterbury's famed historic cathedral. A few blocks away, she turned into the Chaucer Hotel, one of the city's modest old inns. After checking into neighboring rooms, the women met for dinner in the hotel restaurant. Summer devoured a large plate of fish and chips, not realizing how hungry the day's excursion had made her. Julie nearly matched her appetite, pushing away a plate cleaned of pasta. If you'd like to walk the meal off, we can take a stroll over to the cathedral, Julie offered. I appreciate the tour guide offer, Summer replied. But to be honest, I'd like to spend some more time analyzing Kitchener's diary. Julie beamed at the reply. I was hoping you'd say that. I've been anxious to study the writings since we checked in. There's a quiet lounge off the lobby. How about we order some tea and take another pass through the diary there? I'll take notes while you read this time, she added with a smile. That would be lovely, Julie agreed. I'll go get the diary and a notebook from my room and meet you there. She climbed the stairs to the second floor and entered her room, then hesitated when she noticed her work papers strewn across the bed. The door suddenly slammed shut behind her as the lights were flicked off.
A shadow approached as she started to scream, but a gloved hand quickly covered her mouth before her voice could resonate. Another arm slipped around her waist and pulled her tight against the assailant, who seemed to be wearing padded clothing. Then a deep voice grunted in her ear. "Don't make a sound, or you'll never live to see the dawn."